This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, this is By the Book with Lee Chui Lin and Shamila Gunnison, and today we have an interview lined up for you. So a little while ago, we spotted an article on The Guardian headlined, "Why Would One Man Read Mark Twain's Whole Library?" And then we wondered, why indeed?
We also wondered, who is this man? So we actually tracked him down. His name is Dr. Alan Gribben. He is the co-founder of the Mark Twain Circle of America and author of Mark Twain's Literary Resources. So clearly a Mark Twain fan.
Yes.
And so he joins us on the line today to discuss his work. Alan, thanks for being on the show. So what began your interest and fascination with Mark Twain?
Well, I was always interested in the 19th century because I think it explains so much about the century that followed and now the century that we're in. If you understand the preceding century, it's quite revealing about how we got to where we are. So I always wanted to study a figure in the 19th century. And then I had the good fortune to be employed as an editor for the Mark Twain Project, which is an enterprise at the University of California, Berkeley, publishing Mark Twain's unpublished works, such as his notebooks and his letters, as well as his previously published works. And I worked there while I was getting my PhD in English. And I soon found that here was an author who knew everybody, it seemed, in the 19th century, traveled widely, even around the world. And so I realized he could teach me so much about the 19th century if I just studied him, his life, and his writings.
And on that note, how did that then lead to his readings? Because, I mean, that is something that you look at especially. What interested you in what Mark Twain read?
Well, as I started to choose a doctoral dissertation subject, I wanted something that was original, that no one else had worked on very much, and that would be useful to the whole field. And quite a few of the senior scholars told me, oh, I wish we knew what he read, because his books were sold at two auctions in the decades after his death, and widely, widely scattered, and the catalogs of the sales leave much to be desired as the fullness of the information. And then he gave thousands, perhaps several thousand, books to libraries as he was in his final years. He wanted to encourage other people to read, and so he gave these to public libraries. And again, the records are rather limited there. So here was a subject that a young person, I was in my late 20s, could really tie into. And I wrote to libraries and collectors, and I traveled all over the United States. Thank goodness most of the books stayed in the United States, so they were widely dispersed. And then I began to put this together. And then, of course, there is a lot of information in his letters and in his notebooks and in his various writings, fiction and otherwise, that informs us about what he was reading and his opinion of it. So I organized all this gradually into a massive alphabetical catalog, author by author.
It sounds more than a research project. It sounds almost like an excavation of sorts. Can you tell us a little bit about the experiences while you were sort of unearthing these books, because you were also putting them into a sort of timeline as well? What was this experience like?
Well, I ended up not stopping with my doctoral dissertation, although eventually after I expanded that for another 10 years, I did published two volumes of it. But now, in the some 30 years after that, I've continued to work on it. So I now have been working on it for a half century, and I'm pretty well going to wrap it up with these volumes that are coming out. But you're right. It was, I have to say that I have lived more in the 19th century on weekends and nights than I have in my own century. I followed Mark Twain into various little byways and weed-choked alleyways and up cul-de-sacs as he explored works that we've never heard of and authors that are not familiar at all. But I wanted to be able to reproduce in print something of the patterns of his reading. And it's been tremendously edifying. I think the main thing I will bring to the public that will be so useful is an index. I have indexed this by subject so that you, for example, could look up a subject that you might not be aware that he was much into, but he was, spiritualism and psychic readings, for example. I think he has at least a dozen books on that subject, and also on related subjects such as ghosts and other manifestations of the other world. He was very fascinated with this line of inquiry, and he especially wanted to follow up on laboratory experiments along these lines. But one can look up, for example, African-American plantation spirituals, and those are listed. Every sort of thing that you can imagine, I've tried to lead readers to very quickly and efficiently so that they can look up and see what he was familiar with. I have to say, the recovery can never be complete because of these book sales that I was talking about, these auctions, and some of his donations were not recorded. So we'll always never have a complete listing. But what I have brought forward gives a good idea of what his interests were and how ardently he pursued some of these ideas.
Overall then, what were the main findings that you discovered about Mark Twain's reading, specifically to do with his reading habits, I suppose? What kind of a reader was he?
Well, I think the main finding that I would bring to your listeners is he read much more and much more voraciously than anyone had supposed. And yet, for some reason, he tried to mask this fact. In newspaper interview after newspaper interview, he would say things like, oh, I read very few novels, I read hardly any poetry, and so forth. I believe this was because he didn't want to be accused of being influenced by anyone. If he praised an author, even an author of a preceding generation, some critics might say, oh, look, you can see how much he depended on this author for his plot lines or his characters or something. He had seen this happen to some of his friends. I think this was a great concern to him. But at any rate, he was much, much better read than people have imagined. And there is a tendency among a certain type of literary critic to dismiss Mark Twain as something of an intellectual lightweight, a figure merely popular for his humor, when they have to face up to the fact that he read all the classic novels and read deeply in medieval and early literature, though because of his lack of education, he read in translation, in English translation. He read a great many ancient classics of ancient Rome and ancient Greece, was very familiar with the leading authors of that era. And so I think he'll just have to be reevaluated now and taken much more seriously as someone who read deeply and continually in subjects we weren't aware that he was pursuing.
Mm. And what is the importance and value, I suppose, of knowing what these sort of celebrated authors read? Is it about their influences?
Well, this was a view for a while, I think some decades back, that there was a certain school of criticism known as source studies that would pounce upon proof that an author read another author and that they had similar passages in certain books or something. This is now considered passé by most students of literature because we realize that literary genius works so complexly, it's not at all that simple. What I've brought forward is what I call Mark Twain's literary resources. These are resources. These are the books that he and his family swam in. They had a very bookish family. He and his wife and daughters exchange books for birthdays and Christmas and occasions. They gave books to their friends. They gave books to their relatives. We must remember that during the era that Mark Twain inhabited, 1835 to 1910, this was the perhaps the high point of the print media as a means of transmitting knowledge and information and literary models. Thus, to understand that he was acquainted with so much of the publication in his day, I think is very important for biographers and for merely the general reader who'd like to get a picture of this author. I have to add one other thing, too. Don't know if it's true in your country, but in the United States, a great many sociologists and culture historians are currently wringing their hands about the fact that the younger generations are not reading much. The advent of the internet and other temptations for keeping them glued to their smartphones and their laptops and so forth have pulled them away from the printed word. And I think it's somewhat encouraging, maybe even inspiring, to know that here's an author who was taken out of school in the fourth grade when his father died young and his father was in debt. And like Charles Dickens, he was put to work immediately and never had a chance to finish his formal education at all. And he is what we call an autodidact, a self-taught person. He used his work in newspaper offices and printing shops to use every opportunity to teach himself how to read, what to read, and he vigorously pursued that all his life. I have to say that he was much better read than most of his literary contemporaries.
On the line with us today is Alan Gribben, talking about tracking down Mark Twain's entire library and the value of knowing what the great man read. We're going to be continuing our conversation after this. You are listening to By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Sharmila and Lynn. On the phone with us is Alan Gribben, author of Mark Twain's Literary Resources. So Alan, earlier you were talking about how Mark Twain's reading habits would probably surprise us and many of his contemporaries, and your work actually traces Twain's reading over time, and he's so closely associated with 19th century America. How do those reading choices, if at all, intersect with American history?
I think I can show from the catalog that I'm bringing out that, and this is a catalog of, well, my first version of the catalog back in 1980 was 5,000 entries. I've added hundreds and hundreds of new entries now, including separate entries for poems, plays, novels, essays, anything he read gets a separate entry. But I think I can show that he was greatly influenced by his reading. It was through his reading, more than perhaps anything else, that he became ashamed that he had ever endorsed his father's views about the enslavement of African Americans. He grew deeply, deeply chagrined that he had ever agreed with his father's support of the institution of human slavery, and in fact tried to atone for that in his later in life by donating funds to help African Americans with their education, and at one point even saying there is never enough that we can do to make up for what we did to these people. I think it was through his reading of slave narratives by enslaved people who escaped and dictated their narratives or wrote their narratives of their life in enslavement, as well as the anti-slavery novels that he read by people such as Harry Beecher Stowe, who became one of his next-door neighbors in his later life, and other writings, so that shortly after the Civil War, he turned a large corner. And I think it was very humbling to him to realize how people can be carried along by the prejudices and the circumstances of where they happen to live and become so conformist as to countenance an inhuman institution such as slavery. I don't think he ever looked at human conduct the same again once he realizes. And if one thinks about the rather subversive message of Huckleberry Finn, the message underneath Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the most famous novel he wrote, one will see that it's an argument that even people with good hearts, like a young boy, Huck Finn, can be consumed and by this social conformity and be blind to certain injustices. I could also direct readers to books he read about the Native Americans that made him, toward the latter decades of his life, very sympathetic to the plight of these conquered tribes, and really turned him around on that score too. Reading was very had a very great impact on him. He also, as we know, turned against colonialism and the policies that supported it in the United States as well as in other countries. And this was, of course, partly because of the journey he made around the world that he recorded in a book called Following the Equator. But he also referred throughout that book to anti-colonial publications that he had been reading that had turned him around on this. So he was a person not afraid to challenge his own beliefs and not afraid to change those beliefs. He was not so insistent on adhering to one view as he was in curious exploration of other points of view, which left him, of course, in some cases, on the fence, that he would read books on one side and then on the other and so forth.
Do you think someone like Mark Twain would have wanted or appreciated this sort of examination of his reading?
No. I'll be honest. I think he'd be wagging his finger at me that I've exposed a secret that he tried throughout his life to keep. On the other hand, remember, he was keeping this secret for the reason that is rather a moot point now, and that is his market value. He had a great readership among the less educated classes of readers at that time. We're talking about the 19th century, mechanics, farmers, and so forth, who hadn't had much of a chance themselves to extend their education very far. And Twain was very concerned that he not appear snobbish or too learned, too much the elite author. And so I think it was very commercially helpful to him to seem to just sort of spring out of the Missouri soil in an original form and not be affected by reading very much literature and so forth. I have to say, in my opinion, Mark Twain was quite possibly the most commercial literary artist we ever produced in the United States. He was all about show me the money. And this is because, you know, when his father died, he left them so bankrupt that their house was put up for public auction on the steps of the county courthouse, and a more affluent uncle came down from St. Louis and outbid the other bidders and gave them their house back. Otherwise, they would have been homeless. So this would make a very great impression on a person only 11 years old or so. And so he never forgot the taste and the odiousness of extreme poverty, and he always craved commercial success, and one cannot blame him. But I think at this late date, when his stature seems pretty secure, it's fine for us to pry open some of these secrets of his and let the world know that he was a secret reader.
And Alan, you know, in closing, this book represents, like you said, it's a culmination of now half a century's worth of work. You know, what's What's next for you? Are you going to continue delving into this? I mean, what do you have coming up?
Well, first of all, I have to get volumes 2 and 3 out. What is coming out this month is volume 1, and it is 25 chapters that explore the patterns of his reading and how deeply he loved, for example, the poetry of Robert Browning and Rudyard Kipling and Tennyson and so forth. And I go into a great many of these writers, for example, Shakespeare. Who would know that he knew his Shakespeare so well that in letter after letter, he would just sort of breathe lines that just flowed out of his memory bank. He knew Hamlet by heart. He knew Shakespeare better than most English professors, I think. And anyway, this book looks at those patterns of his reading. And one chapter that I think quite a few people will enjoy looks at the hilarious way that he annotated many of his books, putting in little jokes and making fun of the grammar of certain books and making fun of the ideas and so forth. So I quoted quite a bit of what we call his marginalia, comments that he wrote in the space that's allowed on the margins of the books. And that I call Mark Twain's Library of Literary Hogwash. That's a term that he liked to use for books that he didn't care much about, Library of Literary Hogwash. And then at the back of this volume 1, there's a extensive critical bibliography of all the work that's ever been done on this subject before me. There's, of course, just scores and scores of people who've contributed, so I assess all their work and give them credit. Volumes 2 and 3, as I say, are going to consist of this very extensive catalog of each and everything we know him to have read, and try to assess the influence it had on his thought and his writings, and then conclude with a huge index that will lead interested readers to certain subjects that they might want to look at, as to how much he knew about the American Civil War or how much he knew about British history, and all this will be listed there.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you for being so interested in it, and I look forward to perhaps talking with you again when volumes 2 and 3 come out. That'll be next year in 2020. Thank you very much.
That was Alan Gribben, author of Mark Twain's Literary Resources and co-founder of the Mark Twain Circle of America, talking about, well, you guessed it, Mark Twain and the books that Mark Twain read.
And now we come to footnotes, where this week we are taking a look at the fact that we recently did a show about adaptations, because when do we ever miss out on an opportunity to talk about Neil Gaiman? And Good Omens hit our screens on the 31st of May. So it's a couple of things now. We're going to talk a little bit about how we feel as book readers about the adaptation of Good Omens.
Because we must have an opinion.
We must. And, you know, it is, after all, Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, and here we are. So, but during that show, we also asked you about your thoughts on adaptations that you'd like to see. And we're just going to run through a couple that came in.
Yes. So Zach texted in to say, Dr. Zhivago, American Psycho, Trainspotting and Goodfellas are all great examples of, I'm assuming he's saying that they're great examples of books that had been adapted into movies. But Zach did not agree with my my opinion that Hunger Games was a good one. He said, oh, come on, Hunger Games was a failure. If I'm a hungry, male-nourished human being, I wouldn't look like that.
In all fairness, I don't think anybody also wants to see that on screen in a big blockbuster film. I mean, an argument could be made perhaps that it's what we need to see, but it is an understandable decision considering that it is an action film franchise.
Yes. But point well taken. Mm. Not everyone needs to like every adaptation.
Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family. Choose a big television. Choose washing machines, cars, compact displays and electrical tin openers.
Yeah!
Choose good health, low cholesterol and dental insurance. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose your friends. Choose leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suite on hire purchase and a range of fabrics. Choose DIY and wondering who you are on a Sunday morning. Choose sitting on that couch watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing junk food into your mouth. Choose your future. Choose life. But why would I want to do a thing like that? I chose not to choose life. I chose something else. And the reasons? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got head on?
Trainspotting is a good one that we did not mention. And I think Trainspotting is... some of Irvine Welsh's books have been considered unfilmable.
Yes.
Trainspotting is not necessarily that, but it did manage to capture that sense of grittiness and forward motion and just language. It was a beautiful movie, and hard agree, Zach.
Chia Sun Seng also wrote in to say, there's this series on magic and grand fantasy, aptly titled Magician by Raymond E. Feist, which I think would make a brilliant movie or TV adaptation. Quite a lengthy set as well and very rich in details.
I enjoyed Magician a lot. I've not finished the entire Rift War series, but I really did enjoy it. And I agree, they're very well written, they're very rich, and they also take the time to really world build. So it is quite ripe for adaptation. We've spoken about the fact that now is a great time for fantasy and sci-fi.
Exactly.
But whether or not the market gets too crowded for big sagas, I don't know. Although you're absolutely right. I would love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
We also received other messages that came in. This last one here saying that Crazy Rich Asians is by far the worst. The ending is not true at all. Eleanor Young did not attend Nick Young and Rachel's wedding, but the new It is good.
Hiya, Georgie. What a nice boat. Do you want it back?
Yes, please.
You look like a nice boy. I bet you have a lot of friends.
Three, but my brother's my best guess.
Where is he?
In bed, sick.
I bet I could cheer him up. I'll give him a balloon. Do you want a balloon too, Georgie?
Well, I actually agreed that the new It was good. I thought it was a very modern adaptation of, I suppose one could argue that they were actually adapting the movie, the old 80s movie version of It, rather than Stephen King's novel itself.
Mm.
But nevertheless, I thought that it was a very good update on a story that perhaps might have felt slightly dated now.
Yes, my sister made me watch it on a plane. The screen was far too close to my face, and it was horrifying. So yes, I will agree that It definitely did its job. And now coming back to, I guess, the main thing that we wanted to talk about, which was just the adaptation of Good Omens, which is, I think, the rare scenario where a show is actually adapted by the author itself, or one of the living authors, because there were, of course, two, and Terry Pratchett sadly passed on. So it's not always the case that the author of a book actually adapts his or her own work. And with that, I think you see a lot of that effect echoing into the show.
I felt like I was watching a love letter to Terry Pratchett by Neil Gaiman. I mean, the greatest tragedy of Good Omens, and that's a funny word to use, because Good Omens is such a humorous and funny read, honestly, that when Terry Pratchett passed away, I think these years of friendship between Neil Gaiman and Pratchett came to this end where you saw Gaiman sort of saying, you know, he always thought he would write a sequel with Terry.
Mm.
And I almost felt like this was that. It was the same story. I don't think that he would ever really write another novel without Terry Pratchett, but I felt like this was his tribute to him.
I think it's also very, very difficult for people who have a familiarity with that literary friendship as well as the book to come to this fresh. And I think that that was a problem with me in terms of watching it, because I could never tell whether or not, if I did not already know this, would I understand it? So that was a problem. I mean, not of the show, just of my viewing of it, simply because Good Omens is very funny, very dense, wildly, you know, just deviates all over the place. It just runs everywhere. There are footnotes upon footnotes. And so with that, trying to translate that experience into a miniseries, a movie would have been, I don't even know, but a miniseries, yeah. It means that you do have to take the diversions as they come. And because as a book reader, you know that it's the tone and you know that it's going to be this way. I don't know what it would be like to come to it fresh.
I have a couple of people I know who have watched it and don't have that frame. And I feel like they kept feeling like they are just short of getting it. Mm. It's like they understand it's the humor. They even enjoy the camaraderie between, especially David Tennant and Michael Sheen.
Who were amazing.
Oh, they were just fantastic. But it did feel a little bit like, I think it felt like they were being left out of a joke.
Ah, and that was the thing, right? Because this was something that Neil Gaiman said he was going to adapt in a way for Terry Pratchett. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel that there is a sense of, if you get it, you get it. And it was made with a lot of love. It was made with a lot of respect, but also a healthy amount of, well, this I'm going to keep from the text, this I'm going to throw away, which I was glad to see. I was glad to see that he did prune,
yes,
where necessary, because
I mean, that's actually the danger when the author himself is running the show, right?
Yeah.
Because the compulsion to want to cram in everything, because these are all your darlings and you don't want to kill any of them. I loved the little literary elements that did make it in the best way that you can. I love the narration by Frances McDormand, a quote-unquote voice of God. And that, I think, added and tied together the... And we talked about in this previous show, the idea of the tone of the show. When they start and that line comes up with about the salad. And I'm like, oh, this is going to sound exactly like the voice in my head when I read the book.
And yet there were also additions, right? There were things in there that were not part of the book all the way up to the end.
Yes.
And that made it great, I think. That kind of put the cherry on top for my experience of watching it, because I was like, what? We're going somewhere new? And I really enjoyed that, because as a book reader, you don't get that all the time. You just don't.
You're always the one sitting in the corner going, well, I already knew that from the book.
Did someone need an explanation? I'm here to be the wiki entry. You know, it's not fun. It isn't always a fun experience. There are, of course, the pleasures inherent to watching these characters who have lived with you for a long time suddenly appear on screen, mm-hmm. and it's like, perfect, you are perfect. There is a lot of joy in that, but there's also so much joy in you're taking this somewhere new and I get to go along. And I really appreciated that those elements were there as well.
I loved the backstory, so-called, for Aziraphale and Crowley, because, again, the book sort of alludes to it. You're dropped into their friendship and you get the sense that they're close. But because you have these amazing performances by Michael Sheen and David Tennant, and you get to see them do those little sort of epochs in history and how they became friends, and then later to see that pay off, you know, down the line when Crowley thinks that he's lost Aziraphale. I mean, it was just beautiful.
It was. They've known each other for 6,000 years. It's awfully long time.
Yes, and they really let you feel it in a way that I think that you didn't quite feel as much in the book, but you do feel that in the show.
How long have we been friends? 6,000 years.
Friends, we're not friends. We are an angel and a demon. We're on opposite sides.
We're on our side.
We have nothing whatsoever in common. I don't even like you.
You do.
Armageddon is coming.
And then it's all over. No more fascinating little restaurants where they know you. No more old bookshops.
There must be some way of stopping it.
We have to work together. It's the end of the world we're talking about. It won't be the war to end all wars. It'll be the war to end everything.
Hey,
Have you watched Good Omens? By the way, we also reviewed it on Skip Intro, which you can check out. But this is our book reader's edition of that. If you've watched Good Omens, whether you've read the book or not, let us know what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 and write us at buythebook@bfm.my. You've been listening today, as the email address said, to Buy the Book. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.